Support for WGBH comes from you and White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill Village. You can join them at the Westwood Public Library September 30th from 2 to 3:30 for Memory Cafe, a social gathering for those with memory loss and their caregivers. More at whiteoakcottages.com. And North Shore Music Theater's production of Chicago, a scintillating mix of funny, sophisticated, and sexy rolled into one night at the theater. Chicago plays September 23rd to October 5th. More information at nsmt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're about halfway through our first three-hour show, every day now, 11 to 2. Here with us in Studio 3 for All Revved Up to take on the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. It's great to see you both.
Hey, thanks for having us back.
It's great to be back.
So we have had all these disasters with Ray Rice beating up his then girlfriend, now wife, the Adrian Peterson beating his child with beating a lot of us would say, with a switch. Is there any road to redemption for these people? Michael Vick, I mean, I'm not comparing it because he was abusing dogs and not human beings as far as we know, but he has sort of you're shaking your head, Irene. Maybe
he was an NFL quarterback, for those who don't follow football.
Yes, he was an NFL quarterback, and he was doing this horrible pit bull dog fighting ring, and he was in big trouble for that. He went to jail for 3 years. Was it 3 years?
I think so. It's a little shorter, though.
Anyway, he went to jail for the dog fighting thing. But is there any way back? Is Ray Rice just done? Peterson just done? Or can they find a way to redeem themselves? I mean, you guys are reverends. You're all about redemption here. Emmett Price, what do you think?
I just want to say I'm glad you started with Emmett because I think it's irredeemable. But
okay.
It gives you hope.
Absolutely, there's redemption here. And we have to separate and distinguish redemption from penalty, right? I think Ray Rice should go to jail. Just from what we saw on the video itself.
Yep.
So redemption comes as a product of one serving one's time, right? You have to be punished for those type of offenses. Redemption comes, one, when you move out of the spotlight, right? So we have to move as American consciousness beyond the video footage and to the point where they can have safe space so that they can have some counseling. There's a pathology here that we have to get to the bottom of, that Ray Rice, you know, whether his background or whatnot, that we have to get into and change the nature of that pathology in order to do the work that's necessary for him to be redeemed.
Now, before we hear Irene Monroe say there's no road to redemption, just to stay with you, Emmett Price, it seems to me, as someone who doesn't do this reverend thing like you two do, the first step is an honest and open admission of how wrong what you did was. I mean, to hear Adrian Peterson talk about, well, I'll tell you one thing, maybe I this, maybe I that, but I'm no child abuser. He is a child abuser.
That's right.
I mean, it seems to me until you admit your sins, for lack of a better expression, then there is no road to redemption. That is step one, yes?
That's absolutely true, but there's hard work that has to be done before that, because in his pathology, he's just another line of generations.
Right, his mother said that she did the same thing.
Yeah, as Irene would say, flogging, right?
Uh-huh.
So for him, he's not an outlier. It's normative behavior. So we have to do enough work intervention to show him that in 2014, that's not normal behavior, for him to acknowledge that it was wrong, and then we have the road to redemption.
But I know you're bursting at the seams here, Irene, but before we get to you, and then you can respond to everything Emmett said, Is it possible to redeem yourself to the extent that you can go back to the NFL, or is he done, Adrian Peterson and Ray Rice? Are they done playing football?
Well, I think they're done playing football, because by the time that they get to the point of having done all the work that's necessary, they're probably going to be too old.
Okay. Okay, Irene Monroe, no road to redemption, you say.
No road to redemption whatsoever. And, you know, the very interesting thing is America loves a redemption story because it's transformative. You know, it's about healing. It's about right relationship. The reason why we're even bringing up this topic is because in Goodell trying to reform himself, he will be able then on the surface to redeem the league here.
That's
so
basically,
he's trying to save his butt.
Yeah, he is.
Okay, so and then he's also trying to save the dollars, because one of the things that we have you know, data on is that women are pro football's most important demographic group. We make up about 45% of the NFL's over 100 million viewers. But not only that, I mean, the advertising dollars that go to us. You now see football ads in women's magazines. But the interesting thing is also this. Saturday Night Football, it's targeting a group between the ages of 18 and 49 and Super Bowl Sunday. And, you know, and I'm a victim of it. And I despise the sport. but I love I love halftime. And you know, I really,
boy, that's a first.
And the interesting thing is Super Bowl has logged higher female viewership than the Oscars, the Emmys, and the Grammys combined. But I want to say this in reference to Emmett, because he said there's pathology here. The pathology, while clearly it is in, you know, Peterson's life and the way in which he was reared, the pathology that nobody really wants to address is the pathology of football, how they create and lord these sort of gladiators to be these sort of violent men, you know, on the field, and we make this silly. Okay, you're disagreeing with me.
No, but I don't want you. I don't want you to respond, because I want to say, Irene, I've never said this before. All the years I know, I don't believe you believe what you're saying. Not this part. The no redemption thing. There are a lot of men and women who have done things. It's hard to say this because it sounds like you're excusing this, which I surely am not. There are a lot of people who have done far worse things than hit their wife or hit their kid. And I guarantee you, I know you well enough to know, you say they have either found the Lord, found themselves.
Found Jesus.
So essentially, are you saying that anybody who's done, committed violence against anybody else cannot be redeemed? You're not a chance in the world.
Well, let me just say this. Then Adrian Peterson can. This is what he can do.
What, if you beat up a kid, you can?
No,
and if you beat up a woman, you can?
No, this is what he can do, because he's on the Wheaties box, and there are a lot of kids that look up to him. And a lot of kids are making that association. This guy, you know, who I just laud, who is one of my gladiators, beat up his kid. So this is what I think he can do, at least surfacely, because I'm always about behavior modification. His mea culpa moment would be to go on Sesame Street, talk to the Muppets, and say, you know, I did a wrong, and explain why beating your kid is a problem. I think that's the only thing that he could do. But
so
I still think
there is redemption, then.
Well, at least topically. Topically.
She was against redemption before she was for it. See, my attitude
it's my
is...
It's my presence.
Maybe it is. You know, Emmett Price, see, my sense is that in many ways... I've told this story before to Marjorie, and it's less severe. When I was a city councilor in Cambridge for one illustrious term, I think Irene may have actually voted for me.
I did, and wrote a column.
Oh, that's right,
that's
you
right,
did. And
that's
it was
right.
One of my finest.
I got you, and you owe me, seriously.
I do.
I got you the LGBT vote.
You did. It was huge.
Okay.
It actually was huge. Putting this, I went to as a city councilor, you got to go to a lot of things that you think are going to be horrible, you don't want to go to. I was invited to this, it's called Stars at the high school, and I went. I had no interest in going. I brought a book so I could read during the thing. It was one of the great events ever. You know what it was? It was kids who had either been perpetrators or victims of dating violence, talking to other kids about dating violence, and particularly the perpetrators. And again, they had gone through this process you talked about. I think that arguably, and I'm not putting jumping the gun, they have a lot of suffering to do and a lot of punishment they've got to suffer through. I think people like Rice and Peterson, if they really are reformed, if they really do get it, and I have no idea if they ever will, they have far more ability to change people's minds than all the pontificators like us.
Yeah.
I don't mean you. I
mean
like people like me and others who say, well, this is what you got to do. Isn't that the road for them ultimately, if it's sincere?
They can be the most effective because of their notoriety, because of their names, and because of the stories that they have, and because of their testimonies. I mean, you know, one of the things that we're big on is the testimony. And the reality is all of us are flawed in many different ways. The majority of us have not been caught.
Why does Irene not get this by the way?
This is too saccharine, because, you know, the whole idea is that in order to really redeem behavior, you got to also redeem the structures that perpetrates that kind of behavior. And if you're not going to deconstruct what I see as the misogyny implicit in football, the sort of, you know, domestic violence that runs deep, you know, within the institution.
But hold on for a second, Irene. I don't think we know that. I don't think we know that the NFL is any worse than the average Joe's on the street. We have people. You go to the district court on Monday morning.
Public.
It's full of people.
Absolutely.
And how is Ray Rice going to fix the structures? He can't fix the structures.
And if that was the case, then we would have more hockey players.
Well, not only hockey,
but
rugby players as well. absolutely. Yeah. But my whole idea is that we're a culture that glorify violent sports. And then we wonder why this off-field behavior that we see on field, you know, is played out in their personal lives.
But we have domestic abuse in the church. We have domestic abuse on Wall
Street. You got that
right.
In politics.
In politics. And these are not the, you know, essential, you know, physical gladiators, yeah, as it were. I think one is a systemic notion of our culture. And we've gotten away from, you know, really trying to be our best. You know, the golden rule is about gold and not the rule anymore, right?
I mean, well, the issue about redemption, like, let me tell you what the redemptive issue is. It's not for Rice. It's not for Peterson. Can we redeem a person who prefers the halftime show to the actual game? That would be Irene Monroe. Okay, let's move to somebody who is, for the most part, a little less controversial. 30th anniversary of The Cosby Show.
Oh, he's controversial.
Here's a little sound where Cliff Huxtable, otherwise known as Bill Cosby, tries to convince Rudy to finish her Brussels sprouts.
I remember a little girl, and she wouldn't eat her vegetables, and the parents said, well, you're just going to sit there until you eat them. And she saw her friends growing up. People were going to college. She was still sitting there in the same clothes she had on when she was 5 years old.
That is pretty funny.
Now, I thought, as a white American, this was a big deal show because I saw for the first time on TV this family, very well-to-do family with this gorgeous house, which you saw every week, and she was a lawyer and he was a doctor, you know, really well-educated. This was like the first black family I saw portrayed this way, but I'm white. Now, what difference do you think it made in the black world?
Well, that's why it was controversial.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
for many people, it was aspirational. This was the fiction of what the black family could be. However, in certain communities, we understood this as the reality, right? The kind of hidden reality of many black families who were upper middle class, who owned brownstones in Brooklyn Heights, you know, who had done well for many generations, going back to the Renaissance in Harlem and even before that, where you had black millionaires and black doctors and black bankers and whatnot.
That's right.
And because of the way the history has been taught, we've been taught that more African Americans and black folks have been on welfare
and are
in poverty, as opposed to the reality that there have been folks like the Huxtables before there was the Huxtables. So this was controversial, particularly in the mid-80s when you're kind of coming off the whole 60s and the 70s in Vietnam. And, you know, how are we going to look at this kind of peaceful moment? Are we going to move towards equality? And this was a projection almost of social, political, and economic equality, as it were.
And it was, you know, it's very interesting. It was very important at the time that we begin to see America resegregate itself. And we're in the AIDS epidemic.
What do you mean by that, Peter?
Resegregated. Well, the gains. A lot of the gains now that were won in the 60s and even in the early 70s, we began to lose ground with Reagan's administration followed by the other, you know, Republican presidents. The very interesting thing about The Cosby Show that I loved about it, it recoded blackness. And what it did was it really got away from the stereotypical roles of us, African-Americans, as custodians, as maids, servants, clowns, and buffoons. And he did on television what Toni Morrison has always done in her novels, which is normalize blackness.
Yeah.
And how they normalize blackness is not by preaching anything or saying anything, but you would see this painting called The Homecoming by Jacob Lawrence, or someone like Sammy Davis Jr. would appear on the show. You had an array of you know, Bill Cosby wearing sweatshirts that really promoted the historically black colleges and universities. And the interesting thing about that, during that show, there was a spike in students of color entering college. Because his spinoff was A Different World,
right,
and particularly going to historically black colleges. It was quite interesting and quite transformative. And so, you know, I miss it, and every once in a while when I can get a moment, I watch the reruns. But the interesting thing is this, though, and this is important. In 1992, a book came out called Enlightened Racism, The Cosby Show, Audiences and the Myth of the American Dream. And the conclusion from that book was that the show's representation of successful blacks was so effective that it distorted white America's perception about African-American progress. And it allowed whites to feel a sense of self-satisfaction about race relationships.
That's a great point.
And maybe there's some truth that I hadn't thought about, but I have to say Marjorie identified herself as a white person, so maybe I'll do the same.
I always thought you were passing, but okay.
But, you know, the whole notion, it seems to me that if you combine the impact on this culture, on the white cult part of the culture, mm-hmm. of this show and All in the Family, which brilliantly mocked racism, as brilliantly as it's probably ever been on television, it really did change how whites viewed people of color in this country. I mean, I think the mindset was, despite the imperfection, oh, my God, they're exactly like us, except maybe a little better educated, maybe they have a little more money, but they're exactly like us. And then we laughed at Archie Bunker. I mean,
it pushed the boundaries.
It didn't fix anything, but at least cracked minds open of white people. Like, lives of blacks are not that dissimilar in some core ways.
Right.
That's a fair statement, no?
I thought it fixed a lot of things. I mean,
like
not systemically, but I thought, like, using Archie Bunker, it fixed the whole notion of our silence around racism. Okay, and that even the most well-intended person, because the interesting thing about Archie, even though he was racist, you saw this man's heart.
Oh, totally.
And so you begin to see how he's trapped in this, what I call, intractable web of a racist culture that in many ways, even the well-meaning person, because of language and culture mm-hmm. and all of that, is racist. And what the Cosby Show did, what I thought was interesting, not only was it aspirational, but it had a profound impact that we couldn't see until 2008. It had a lot to do with that because in many
2008
ways...
2008 as in Barack
right,
Obama.
That's right, because the Obamas are Cosby product of that. And it also, the spinoff, and a wonderful spinoff, was the French, the Prince of Bel-Air. The interesting thing
because they were
black Republicans, and the father was a judge. And it was one of those times where you have black family life here with the Cosbys and the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air that are not the Evans on Good Time. And the interesting thing is, juxtaposed to like Bernie Mac's show, Bernie Mac enters this socioeconomic, you know, strata because he was an entertainer. And the show was really aspirational in this way that I agree with you, Emmett, in that you can also do it by education.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was fabulous.
I mean, one of the things that it did solve in television was it broke away from the old minstrel show model. And the minstrel show, you know, from the late 19th century into the early 20th century was a kind of spoofing,
Amos and Andy.
You know, blackface of whites making fun of blacks, and then eventually blacks making fun of whites making fun of blacks. Which you'll find in Sanford and Son, and you'll find in some of the sitcoms of the 70s, 60s,
and 50s.
But even
today, Martin's show, all of them. I mean, the interesting thing about it, that with that came a lot of pushback, because folks felt that the Cosbys weren't authentically black. And it really troubled me, because they would feel...
Why were they not?
Well, at the time, because what they had to do was they had to create a role for Cousin Pam, who lived in the Bronx and whose mother couldn't take care of her. And so they sent her to the Cosby Show.
I don't remember Cousin Pam.
Oh, you don't remember Cousin Pam?
No, go ahead, tell us.
Okay.
Neither do I.
Cousin Pam then ends up on Living Single.
Yeah.
Okay, Cousin Pam, right, was a teenager who comes and walks into the Cosby. I've never seen this kind of palatial, you know, expanse of a place and people living like this. And so she was supposed to be the representative of the voice of folks who said these kind of people are not real. If anything, they're Afro-Saxons at best.
Yeah, and there are a number of incidents, you know, when the show began, there was no oldest daughter, Sonia.
That's right.
And so there was an opportunity where they allowed for a college educated child of the family to come into existence. And then you have, you know, the entry of Denise's husband, who's a military guy, and his daughter.
To show black patriotism,
right. So
that,
you have
that we don't get a sense
all of these
see.
Kind of reactions to some of the criticism and also some of the social and political situations of the day that this show interacted very, very courageously, which other shows and other creators wouldn't
do. You know, there's a new book out now that on Bill Cosby. Crosby, and the New Yorker has a piece on him. But what we got to give him is that he really was a genius in transforming not only society's perception, but a really, you know, a failing network. NBC was not doing well until the Cosby Show came, and he wanted to do it by we need to laugh at ourselves in a way that is not demeaning.
Yeah, and in a very basic kind of way, if you didn't have a great father, you're looking at this guy and thinking, wow, this is what a great father is about.
But let's but my question was, see, back then we didn't have gay children. But I do wonder what the Cosby Show would be and who would be the gay child.
So let's move on for a second, because there is Pope Francis is going to name this new bishop, Blaise Cupich of Spokane, Washington. He's going to be the new Archbishop of Chicago. John Allen, who writes for CruxNow.com, where I am working now, so I'll give a big plug to CruxNow.com, asked in his piece whether we are looking at the American Pope Francis in Chicago, comparing this guy, Cupich, to Pope Francis, in the sense he's all about the poor, not about confrontation, told people in his previous place he didn't want people out protesting nuns and priests out in front of abortion clinics on Saturday mornings, much more in the gospel style of Francis. What do you think, Irene?
Okay, what do you think, Evan? No, Irene, I'm only kidding.
I'm not that hopeful.
Why
I'm
not?
I'm just not. You know, the interesting thing is that we do very little to address women's roles in the Catholic Church. If you really are talking about a transformative church, you got to give women, you know, the right to ascend to being clergy.
But wait a second, Irene Monroe, I couldn't agree with you more. But if the choice was between picking a successor to Cardinal George, who was Cardinal George Part II,
right,
or this Cupich guy, you'd pick Cupich in a walk, right? I mean, isn't it
you know, it's the whole idea of that, you know, here's the litter, and my whole thing is the whole litter is no good.
How about you, Emma Price?
I think it's a great pick.
Of course he would.
I think it's transformational.
Oh, Emmett, you're too saccharine. I can't take it.
Keep it going, Emmett.
I think this, you know, this person would be a you know, kind of a breath of fresh air if he has the courage that he's shown over the longevity of his career in this new post.
Yeah.
Because all eyes will be on him, you know, both nationally as well as internationally. And so I'm hopeful that he will continue this new movement within the Catholic Church, this new movement, which I think I think it'll eventually get to where Irene wants it to get to. I know it's a little slow for Irene, but this kind of inclusiveness.
It's been centuries. Slow. Well, you know what? Not only am I going to pray for you, I'm going to pray for each of you,
well,
too.
Well, thank you. We
appreciate
it.
Because somebody needs to pray for you.
This is the fourth guy he's appointed, though, in the same vein. And it's a sea change from what was getting appointed before. All the guys that were appointed before talked about was abortion and gay rights. Abortion and gay rights. And this is the fourth person that's not going
to be. But see, my whole idea that this politic of silence, not to talk about it, doesn't mean that he's not going to implement the same kind of structure just because he won't talk about it. So that doesn't mean that there's a sea change. That just means there's a politic of silence. I am just disappointed. I'm going to go and pray by myself today. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Irene Monroe, thank you for being here.
By the way, we hadn't even said goodbye. Irene is out of her
seat. She's gone.
She's going right to church to pray for our immortal souls. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you both for coming in, and I'm sorry we disappointed you, Irene. We'll try to do better next week. Up next, it's the first day of fall. We're going to ask you, where you come down this time of year, is this just the gateway season to winter and months of darkness and cold? Or is this a season of beautiful weather, a time infused with the spirit of back-to-school fresh starts and really great apples? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.